Good morning. Lent can be seen as a time for holding up before ourselves where we have failed, a time to focus on repentance, but also a time of fasting, as Jesus fasted for 40 days in the wilderness. We might take on specific disciplines during Lent. And at our Ash Wednesday service, this last week we received ashes on our forehead to remind us that we come from the earth, and to the ashes of earth we will return. About three times a week, I go for a morning run along Grist Mill Road where I live. As I start out, Linville Creek is just to my right. On my left is cattle pasture. I run past the stop sign at Green Hill Road where it turns to gravel. And after just a little bit of a rise, I turn around and head back. It's an idyllic setting where I can imagine for a while that all's right with the world. Except for these. Beer cans, bottles, plastic. These are the beer cans and bottles I've picked up over the past 3 months. Actually, it's more than that. New ones appear each time I run. The same question rises up in me. Who would do this? Who throws their cans out the car or pickup window into the ditch? In this day and age, why? How hard can it be to take these to the trash and put them in your own trash can when you get home? It makes me angry that someone would throw these into the ditch day after day after day. I went running yesterday and I picked three more up. It irritates me I have to clean up someone else's mess, someone else's carelessness. There's more to it than just the cans. It's the realization that there are people, my neighbors, wherever they are, who routinely toss their cans and bottles out the window as if it has no consequences, as if the earth is their dumping ground. What's the mentality where one can do this over and over, where you treat this beautiful land this way? Some see the world as expendable to use and throw away. Someone else will clean it up, or maybe not. Maybe they don't care if the ditch fills up with trash. I know these cans and bottles aren't actually a very consequential problem or even an important issue as we face global warming and climate change. Certainly pollution is a serious problem, but what keeps some of us awake at night is our continued burning of fossil fuels, the warming of our oceans, the steady rise in our average air temperature because of the carbon in the atmosphere. I brought these cans this morning because they're symbolic of the anger I feel about how the culture I live in uses the Earth's resources and then just throws them back. They're symbolic that I feel powerless over what others do with their choices and how that affects all of us, and symbolic as an expression of our wasteful, polluting society. I can pick these up and take them to the recycle bin. I can have a more pleasant place to run when I pick them up. But the problems of our environment, of pollution and global warming, are on a grand scale. Our economy is deeply entangled with systemic dependence on consumption and burning fossil fuels. Needed change can seem overwhelming. Several weeks ago, I read these lines from an article in the Washington Post about the climate crisis. Quote, "Young people have become the defining face of the climate movement, marching, protesting, and berating their elders for bequeathing them an uncertain, unstable future. Underlying their anger, though, is another A word, anxiety, and it's something they're increasingly voicing. Parents, teachers, and medical professionals across the country find themselves face to face with a quandary. How do you raise a generation to look forward to the future with hope when all around them swirls a message of apparent hopelessness? The often apocalyptic nature of the news about climate change is perhaps uniquely paralyzing, unquote. We have deep existential worry and anxiety about the state of our world and its direction. Last quarter, a good number of you joined the Sunday school class here on climate change, and we heard about this anxiety. There's a word being used now for it, eco-anxiety. It's so outrageous that our current political leaders have reversed and are moving in the exact opposite direction we should be going. I heard someone in our class say, in effect, I've stopped listening to NPR. It just gives me such a sense of despair, given our current political crisis, to listen to the news. It can seem like the problems are too big for our small ability to impact change. Take a look at this image. This photo is actually pretty old, taken from Apollo 11 in 1969. For over 50 years, we've been able to view the Earth as this magnificent, beautiful blue globe, and to see it as a coherent whole in a way never before seen by human beings. I'm curious what you see and what comes to mind as you gaze at this view of our world. Some of you remember when photos like this were first shown. And I wonder if it looks different now to some of you in some way than 30 or 40 years ago, knowing what we know now about the threats to our globe. Lent is traditionally a time to take up specific disciplines or to give up something. I've seen several friends say goodbye to everyone on Facebook for Lent. Some of you might be dedicating yourselves to eat more local foods or to stop eating meat during Lent. Fasting one day a week is some people's practice. I'm wondering, are there disciplines that you've decided to embrace for Lent this year? Or if you've decided to let something go? And some of these disciplines could specifically relate to your concern for the earth. Walking instead of driving. Bicycling to work or to church. We heard the story of Jesus being tempted in the wilderness. Actually, a better word is, or translation is, being tested by the evil one. The tests are familiar to most of us. While Jesus is hungry, he's tested whether to turn stones into bread to veer off his discipline of his period of fasting. The second one is to perform a dramatic gesture and for Jesus to prove himself by throwing himself off from a great height and test God's promises. The third, what might have been the biggest test, is the temptation to be the ruler of all the kingdoms of the world and enjoy their splendor, but then must worship Satan, which in my reading today, one might say is to worship greed and consumption and power. What has struck me as I've reflected on this passage is not the specific tests or temptations that Jesus faced, although certainly there are contemporary relevant lessons within these three tests. What strikes me is Jesus being tempted to be a grand spectacle, to be a leader who can command adoring crowds, to use his power to single-handedly transform the world. Maybe the test is Jesus more interested in himself and not as interested in us or our world? Stones to bread, to show off a dramatic, magical performance, to single-handedly exert power and turn the benefits towards himself. And to do it all by himself, to do it in a spectacular way, which leaves all of us staring as spectators. of leaving the problems up to someone else. In the next chapter of Matthew, Jesus begins preaching and, yes, drawing crowds of listeners, but he also calls the first of the disciples. His teaching is about bringing the kingdom of heaven to earth. But the narrative is soon sprinkled with the life Jesus has with his disciples, including women such as Mary and Martha, who were an integral part of the community around Jesus. Jesus does perform miracles of healing, and he does draw large crowds, but through pulling together a group of people who are committed to following him, to working together, sharing their lives with each other, eating together, Jesus models and forms those early Jesus communities, which in fact is what we as a congregation model ourselves on. In visiting several CMC small groups over the past few weeks, I've been reminded of the strong, vital tradition small group commitments have been within the congregation since its beginning. We are a local expression of the way Jesus modeled forming a community around him to put into practice his teachings of love for neighbor, love for God, and yes, love for God's creation. And we do that face to face in our living rooms, around a dining table, and soon, hopefully, in our backyards. And when we celebrate the ritual of the Lord's Supper as we do today, part of that celebration is remembering the community gathered around Jesus, eating and drinking together, not in isolation, but together as a small community. Here's another photo. There we go. I'm guessing most of you haven't seen this one or aren't as familiar. In July of 2013, the Cassini spacecraft took this photo from the back dark side of Saturn, such that Saturn shielded the sun's light in a way that reveals Earth in the distance. Can you see it? Can you see the Earth? See if that goes a little closer. There we go. Maybe just a little hint of blue in the photo. And incidentally, I'm glad that all the children received little spacecrafts during children's time today. Didn't know that was going to happen. As you look at this, I'm curious what feelings or thoughts come to mind as you gaze at it. It took 7 years for the spacecraft to get there, and it orbited Saturn for 13 years, much longer than they expected the mission would last, doing all sorts of studies, including studying the moons of Saturn, before plunging into the planet in 2017. It's another extraordinary view of our world, of this corner of creation, of our unique place in the universe. For me, this viewpoint of our Earth makes it all the more obvious how we and all living things around us are one. In the latter weeks of the climate change class, I heard many of us saying, "We're ready to put some changes into action. What can we do?" Of course, many of us are already very engaged either in personal or more systemic advocacy actions that will reduce climate change and that are a form of creation care. We understand many of the roots of the problem. We spent time talking about what science says are the most effective steps that we can take and about how we conceive of ourselves theologically in relation to the rest of creation, rivers, oceans, the soil, plants, and animals. There is a lot of expertise and experience and resources within our congregation. I'd like to call us to not despair, but to be people of hope. I'd like to call us to take these weeks of Lent and beyond as a time to consider how each of us individually and as a congregation and as part of our broader community can put into practice disciplines for the earth. And it's going to be many different things. We are a body with many different parts. Different ones of us can join in our desire for ecological justice, for creation care, in different ways. How can we support each other? How can we challenge each other? And how can we talk meaningfully with each other across generations, even across differing political and economic points of view? And if you're part of a small group at CMC, I encourage you to talk about these questions together in the coming weeks. Is there something that you as a group intentionally can take on as a creation care discipline? Or in children's Sunday school, in your workplaces, at home, talk about what you're practicing, what you've heard others suggest that we can do, and about what your questions are. We will engage with the Green Congregation Committee that exists here at CMC. Wayne Teal is currently the chair, and we'll hear more from them in the coming weeks. I want to pull our eyes a little closer now to this land right around us. This, too, is along Gristmill Road, taken last summer. The Genesis story we read is set in the Garden of Eden. It is the creation story included in all three Abrahamic religions, Muslim, Jewish, and Christian. Certainly one of the most distinctive lessons of this story that we heard this morning is that we live in a world of moral choices, that our choices have consequences. We see this now in such a profound way with our climate crisis. Our choices make a difference in the kind of world we live in and will pass on to the next generation. And the last image I want to leave you with is here with us every Sunday when we meet. Look above the screen. It's a living, thriving tree, a central symbol of our congregation, which honestly I find very striking is such a central symbol here in our church place. How might you make this symbol meaningful for you and for us during Lent this year?
Listening to the Community Mennonite Church podcast. Our theme music is a setting of John Wesley's text, Jesus, I Believe You're Near, composed by Matt Carlson. Jeremy Nafziger arranged it for strings. To learn more about our congregation or to plan a visit, please check out our website at cmcva.org.